TG Geeks, episode 127, July 24th, 2017. Earth Magic and Disney Magic. Hello and welcome to another webcast from TGGeeks.com, where Ben and Keith, the two gay geeks, talk about all aspects of geekdom and nerdery. Sci-fi, comics, film, horror genre, you name it, we talk about it. I am Keith Lane and we're coming to you from TG Squared Studios in lovely Phoenix, Arizona.
And I am Ben Ragginton, also coming to you from Phoenix, but ooh, I would love to be at a Star Wars hotel right now. Arizona.
Yeah. And we've got an interview, and then we got a bunch of
Disney stories to talk about.
So we're going to get right to it. And this time we have with us Ms. Beth Cato, and she is a steampunk fantasy author and Baketress that lives...
Baketress? Oh, that's a new one. I hadn't heard that one.
I was saving that. I wanted to laugh.
Well, you got it.
You know, I got to get the laugh. Anyway, she is a local author to us here in Phoenix, Arizona, and we are glad that she is on the show. Thank you for being on the show, Beth.
Well, thank you for having me. This is great.
Yeah, and it just so happens that you have a book that's due out any moment now. And what is that book? Tell us a little bit about you and how you got into writing.
Let's do that first.
then we'll
talk about books.
Yeah, then we'll talk about the books. So, how did you get into writing? And what? I assume that's your full time job now, and you're doing that to support yourself and your family.
Yeah, I'm full time writer / stay at home mom. I have a 12-year-old son with autism. So during the summer, I'm with him the majority of the time because of my husband's work hours. And then during the week, I'm the one in charge of getting him to and from quite a bit of therapy throughout the week, or mm-hmm. cleaning the house to be ready for therapists.
Oh, cool. That is really that
admirable.
Yeah. I worked in a sheltered workshop in Albuquerque in a previous life. And we had, people all over the spectrum of autism. So yeah. I fully understand that. And I'm very sensitive to it.
And we lots of respect.
Yes.
Lots absolutely. Of respect for what you're doing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's a lot of work and the therapies and all that. I mean, the wonderful thing is we see real results with everything.
Oh, that's good.
But at the same time, sometimes it is really exhausting, especially when juggling writing deadlines and
and
everything else involved with, you know, housekeeping and, you know, my family actually demands things like food sometimes. And so
oh, good grief. They can feed themselves. I'm just joking.
It's like, man, I have to go grocery shopping again. But yeah, it's a lot to juggle, but it's worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. And at least you have something that you can do at home. And, you know, assuming there's no, you know, nobody having a meltdown like your husband or your son.
What?
Yes. There's no way I could balance everything otherwise. You know, that's the wonderful thing about essentially being a contract writer with Harper Voyager is that I can just work my own hours, work when I need to, get up at 4 a.m. if I have to, and get to work.
Yeah, exactly. So how long have you been writing, and when did you start writing, and when did you start doing it as a full-time?
When did you become professional?
Exactly.
Ooh, well, going back to when I wanted to start being a writer, I mean, that's from my earliest memories. When I was about 4 years old, I was stapling together my own illustrated books, and
I wanted
to write about horses. And then I went into a Laura Ingalls Wilder phase, and I wanted to write Civil War books and Pioneer books. And then in my teens, I went into fantasy novels, and I just always had a dream to grow up and be a writer.
Wow.
And then in my late teens, that dream died.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I had a family pressure against writing in the fantasy genre, you know, being told that, you know, you're going to burn in hell if you write that. It's kind of a downer.
Oh,
my Lord. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, not cool.
Yeah, so I had a lot of pressure on me like that. And then I also had a college writing teacher who saw me reading a fantasy novel one day and sneered at me, "That's not a real book."
Wait a minute.
Oh my God.
Okay, I mean, not, I don't want to, you know, place any age or anything like that, but I'm just curious, what year was that?
That was 1998.
Wow. Holy cow, you would have thought that we'd be a little more enlightened in that respect, because
I still see people going through that same thing today.
Oh, you're joking.
And having that same pressure on them.
Oh, because, gosh. I mean, I remember growing up as a teenager reading science fiction fantasy, and my mother was of the bent where, oh, well, that's not real literature. My stepdad, on the other hand, was more enlightened, you know, being that he was a big fan of writers like Arthur C. Clarke and Tolkien.
Oh, yeah.
So he understood that, yes, you could write very serious, very well-recognized literary works and still be in these genres. Yeah. But, you know, but that, I'm talking 1970s when I had to face, you know, those kind of dark ages. And now with the proliferation of the genres as they are and the different subgenres that exist,
yeah,
I would have thought that there'd be more open-mindedness and greater enlightenment about that. I'm really shocked at this.
Yeah, I wish, but people are always going to find some reason to look down on something, especially, well, you know, course. You see that online way too much.
Well,
way
you know, I am reminded of something.
Oh, there's a troll in the comments.
Yeah. Well, no, but I am reminded of those who can't do, teach.
Yeah.
So maybe we're looking at, you know, a frustrated professor who desperately wanted to be a fantasy writer, bombed at it, became a teacher. I mean, yeah, I'm not casting aspersions against teachers, but who knows? I'm just still shocked that in an institute of higher learning that someone would say something like that. I mean, that's such a narrow point of view.
Yeah.
Well, it is, anyway. And I had no confidence at the time, and I was just essentially lost, and I was like, if I'm not going to read fantasy and if I'm not going to write it, I don't really know where to go in the bookstore anymore. So
wow.
For a number of years there, I just didn't read very much, or I tried to read literary, and I just couldn't really connect with it as well, and then finally, when it was in, gosh, about 2005, my husband was in the Navy. He was deployed or away on the ship almost all the time. I was home with a baby, and I was miserable because I felt like my brain was just rotting away. It was like, yeah, it was all I could do day to day just to get enough sleep to function.
Oh, mm-hmm. My. Wow.
And I realized, it's like, okay, I'm not happy here, but I'm going to be home. I need to kind of rediscover myself and go back to my dreams. And that's when I decided, okay, I'm going to work at becoming a published writer.
You were a closet writer of fantasy.
Yeah, man, I wasn't even in a closet at that point. It was
a cave.
You know, starting from scratch and learning what the industry really was about,
wow,
what to do, where I fit in. And just gradually starting to put out stories to For the Love publications, and then working up to Token Ping publications, and working on novels and writing horrible, horrible novels. And then finding out, hey, they are horrible, so I need to get better at my craft. So writing more short stories, improving those. And then eventually, after a couple of years of work, actually getting a literary agent. And then after a couple of years and writing another book for her, selling that book. And that was The
wow.
Clockwork Dagger.
Wow.
What year was that?
That came out in 2014.
Wow.
Wow. So this is pretty recent stuff.
Yeah, and it's weird because I have Call of Fire coming out. I write in August, and it's bizarre because this is going to be my fourth novel.
Wow. Well, I will say that I'm so glad that you persevered, because
I am too.
When I read Breath of Fire, it was, pardon the pun, it was a breath of fresh air. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and I said in my little tiny review that I did that it is a, what did I say? I said it was an alternative or an alternate historical, God, can I talk today? Alternate historical fiction with steampunk and fantasy thrown in. And that's kind of the way I viewed it, and because it does take place in San Francisco in 1906,
yes,
before the earthquake, and there's lots of similarities, but it's an alternate history.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's the steampunk and the fantasy aspect, and I thought it really spoke
nobody,
to all of my nerd bones.
Nobody is writing anything quite like that. That is a very specific era. You know, to actually break out of the classic fantasy genre and to employ magic, or in this case, geomancy, and to do that in a proper historical setting, even though it is an alternate history, was astonishing. And steampunk has always been associated with science fiction.
Yeah.
So to actually blend these two and yet to really pull it off well, you know, and yeah, you know, as we said, you know, before we actually started recording, yeah, I've only read the first chapter, but and I mean this in all honesty, holy cow, what a first chapter.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I was completely stunned by it. It's absolutely fantastic. I love already the universe that you've set us in.
He has a fondness for San Francisco.
Well,
too.
I do. I was
so
born
he's,
there.
He's from the Bay Area. Awesome.
So. Yeah, I was born in San Francisco. So of course I was trying to read the map on the Kindle. You know, so I was trying to, you know, but the graphic on the Kindle is pretty small. But I absolutely was just completely entranced with this whole concept. So let's talk a little bit about where this idea came from.
Yeah, where did Breath of Fire? I mean, was that just like?
Did you just wake up one time and you had this idea, or was this something that was kind of percolating over a period of time?
Well, Breath of Earth all arises from the fact that I am a native-born Californian. I'm from Hanford, California, right in the smack dab middle of the state. And from my earliest memories, of course, I've known earthquakes.
Oh, yes.
I was 3 years old and in the bathtub when the Coalinga earthquake took place.
Oh,
wow. And in May of 1983... And Coalinga is about 45 minutes away from where we were living. And I was there, just a little kid in the tub, and the water starts splashing out of the tub completely on its own.
Wow.
Which leaves an impression on a kid that age.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
And so I screamed for my mom, and she came to the rescue. And then, of course, after that, you know, my mom used to live in Coalinga, and at the time of the earthquake, my grandparents had actually been driving away from it. So after the earthquake, we actually drove over there and essentially toured the town and saw the aftermath of the earthquake.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And you can look up pictures of it online. Look up Coalinga, California, 1983. And it's just have this profound memory of all of these buildings and apartments with the front walls sheared away so they look like dollhouses.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I was living in the Bay Area at the time.
Oh, okay.
So I remember seeing it on the news. It was very, very shocking to see all that.
Yeah, and it had quite an impression on me at that age. But even as a 3 year old,
well, that's traumatizing.
I wasn't scared by it. I had this morbid fascination with it.
Ah, one of those.
So, yeah,
there you
go.
Oh,
we have an earthquake chaser.
If there's a dead bird along a sidewalk, I'll walk by it every day so I can watch how it decomposes.
Oh, dear.
Oh, okay.
One of those.
As a writer, that's all research, and that's what I can say at this
point. Of course, it's research.
It's all research.
Yeah, those weird searches on Google. It's all for research.
Oh, yeah, the FBI must have quite a file on me. But, so as a kid, I mean, I had this early impression of earthquakes and the devastation that they could cause. And then going through school every year doing our earthquake drills, getting under the desk, cover your head, where do you go in an earthquake, practicing at home. I felt the 1989 San Francisco earthquake in my living room when I was in there with my family.
I was in the Bay Area when that happened, too.
So you felt it a lot more than I did.
Oh, I've got quite a story that I'll share with you when we're off the air. But yeah,
Yeah, well, and, you know, I lived in Hanford, so we were, you know, a good, 3-4 hours away, and by golly, we felt it.
I've only
experienced one earthquake.
Stuff like that. I had this background and this fascination with earthquakes as a Californian, and then I had actually just gotten a verbal acceptance for my Clockwork Dagger books to Harper Voyager, so I was talking with my agent, because, like, okay, this is going to take another 6 months until we have the contract finalized. I can't talk about it. I need to work on another book, another series to help keep me sane during this time. Here are some novel ideas I have in my head. And one of them I threw out there was doing like a steampunk 1906 San Francisco. And my agent was like, yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
there's nothing like that. Go for it. So I started building it out from there and trying to decide, okay, you know, it's like, okay, I want to build magic into this. What kind of magic can I do? And then just, oh, geomancy. Of course, it's, you know, I'm going to be utilizing the earthquake in some new way.
Right.
So let's bring in earth magic and then figured out everything else from there.
Wow, that's amazing. It's a fascinating. And then you have a very strong woman in this as well as several other things that are to be revealed later as you read the book.
I can't wait.
Yeah. But I thought it was a fascinating. The characters are really fascinating. I know that Jeannie says, I'm sorry, I'm speaking in partial sentences. I'm so excited. But Jeannie Koch says that her characters speak to her and tell her where the story goes. And, you know, basically Kitty speaks to her. But when you're writing and a character, you've written something a character wouldn't do, they get really upset about it. I mean, do you have that kind of thing, or is it?
How well connected are you with Ingrid?
Exactly. Sorry.
Pretty well connected. I am a heavy duty outliner. In writing, you have plotters and you have pantsers. A plotter, you write a heavy outline, you do a lot of research, and pantsers just write by the seat of their pants. They start writing, and whatever comes out.
That's Jeannie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's just so productive, and I'm amazed at how she can work like that, because I am just, for my book that I just finished, I had an 11,000 word outline.
Oh my word. Bigger than the book.
And it still involved very heavy revisions going back through and filling in blanks.
Wow.
But a lot of that was historical
trivia
that I had to work in, but also my characters were talking to me a lot as I did the outline. So I had outline where I'm laying out facts, and then I would just have snippets of conversations.
So
you're in there, little things that they demanded that had to be said at these certain points.
I see.
So the characters were already becoming rather realized by the time you started putting pen to paper, shall we say.
Yeah, and at this point, since this was working on the third book, and this is for Roar of Sky that comes out next year. And the characters are very well formed in my head, and especially Fenris. Fenris is the character that everyone absolutely adores in this series, and Fenris just talks very loudly to me and is kind of like my unfiltered voice.
I see. That's great. I loved all the characters. I was really intrigued by where it went in the first chapter. I mean, it was just like it started and then it was like, oh dear, what's going on here? And then all of a sudden, it takes off, you know. I could tell that, obviously, Ingrid was not happy where she was doing what she was. And I knew that there was something else.
It's a very interesting point there.
She's much stronger and much more independent, and she's being, you know, stuffed down, shall we say.
You just hit on something. Is there any kind of parallel between you and Ingrid? I mean, as Keith just pointed out, she wasn't happy doing what she was doing. And you just stated, you know, when you weren't writing, you were miserable because you weren't doing what you wanted to do. Is there any kind of, is there anything personal is this therapy, you know, that you're trying to put some of yourself into any of these books?
I think all authors do self-insertion to some degree just because we are drawing on our own unique life experiences. But I think there's bits and pieces of me in all of my characters.
Oh, cool.
I think Ingrid is actually a stronger person than I am and a more emboldened and passionate person.
She's the person you wish you could be?
In a way, yeah. I really envy her because she can say and do things that I would, you know. I'm agoraphobic. I'm more like Fenris in that. It's hard for me to leave the house. It's hard for me to drive. I drive in my own little safe little local zone, and I drive during the daytime. It's hard for me to go to conventions. I'm OCD, so I do tremendous research so I can feel comfortable and know where I'm going and what I'm doing. And then Sai, another one of my characters, he actually, as it comes out through the books, fights depression at times. And that's something that Ingrid has to help him with and support him through. So there's bits and pieces of me in all of my characters, really.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, not to go too off the topic, but how have you been feeling personally, you know, as you develop these characters and as you give them voice, have you noticed any kind of change within yourself?
Not really, because it's, you know, we talk about books being escapism for readers. They're also escapism for writers.
Right.
So I'm living in this other place and in this other realm. And, you know, in my head, especially the past number of months working on this third book. I mean, I lived in 1906. It was weird getting in a car and driving somewhere. I'm like, oh, yeah. This is the real world. This is what it's actually outside.
You didn't have to put the crystal in.
Well, I can imagine.
No, I didn't have to. You know, I didn't have to charge up the Kermanite. No.
No, I can imagine going to San Francisco would have been really shocking at that point.
Oh yes, yes.
Oh dear! Wow, this is great. And you left it on such a cliffhanger. It's like, oh my God!
Spoilers! you're driving me crazy. Don't do that.
Well,
I like to say the first chapter of Breath of Earth ends with a bang.
It did, quite literally.
Yeah, literally, yeah. And then the book itself, and I remember when I finished it, it's like I was looking online and I said, oh no! And then I messaged you and I said, when's the next book out? Because it was, you know, and I just discovered you at Phoenix Comic Con, and I picked up like 10 books, and I've read all of them now, so finally. Oh. Like, gee, many Christmas. When do I have time to do all of this?
So I'm still playing catch up.
Yeah, and the Breath of Earth was one of those, and I've said this about a couple of books. I couldn't put it down once I started reading it. It so engrossed me and just latched on to me. It's like, when can I read the next page?
Yeah, and that's really a testament to the writing, to be able to grab the reader in such a powerful sort of way. I'm like I said, when I finished with chapter one, I didn't want to stop, but it was 10:30 and I was very tired, so I needed to put the book down.
He slept through half the chapter.
So. I did not. I didn't sleep through half the chapter.
Well,
he kept
plugging along, but I kept hearing this.
I was very tired.
And then I'd see him read a page and then turn the page and then all of a sudden hear again.
Oh yes, the truth comes out. Yes.
But he did read it.
I persevered because it was worth it.
But it was, yeah,
I've been that way trying to finish books sometimes. It's like, oh, I just have a couple chapters left and I'm so tired, but I've got to finish.
I know.
Yeah. Is
that when either
reading or writing or both?
I don't write near bedtime. I do give myself a buffer time there because I have to wind down. Otherwise, my brain is so wired with plot ideas and things that I can't fall asleep.
Yeah.
So I actually have to do like a work day where I make sure I stop working by like 7:30 so that my brain can rest.
Wow, that's amazing.
Do you give yourself some kind of prep time to wind your brain back up for the writing?
Well, when I get up in the morning and get back to my computer, I tend to address things like emails, and if I'm doing little book reviews or things like that, I'll get kind of caught up on that little stuff. And then typically it's like, okay, you know, during the school year, it's like get my son off to school and then I can get to my computer and sit down and really start work then.
And then whenever you have this moment of madness, you go bake cookies or something.
Exactly, yeah, which is very good for brainstorming. It's like get away from the computer,
sure.
Mull over plot points. Yeah,
yeah. You stand there. I mean, I'm a cook. I love to cook, and you would be amazed at the things that I think about while I'm cooking. It's like,
oh yeah,
it's my mind just goes crazy. You know,
It can be very therapeutic, and it's amazing. Like just that kind of quiet, just working. Just doing work, like hand labor, like carving or just staring into space out of a window or gardening, mm-hmm. or a lot of writers in the showers where a lot of ideas will hit them just because it's like white noise and focusing on just getting clean. And all of a sudden these plot ideas start coming at them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So tell us about what's the next one? Call of Fire? Is that
Call of Fire?
Call of Fire. And that is due out any moment.
August 15th.
So you got that. That's already done. It's printing and et cetera. Can you tell us anything about where that one's going? Or I don't want to give too many spoilers.
We don't want to go into spoiler territory, but is there any kind of teaser that you can give?
Continuing on with the saga of Ingrid and et al., shall we say. I won't give anything away.
with the first book, because there's no getting around the fact that the San Francisco earthquake does happen, I like to make a joke, spoiler alert, there's an earthquake.
Right.
Because, you know, it happens, but the reasons why it happens and how it happens are completely different from our history.
Right.
So the earthquake happens, San Francisco is toast, sorry, San Francisco, and this is a world where you have mythological creatures that are real, you have geomancy, you have magic that arises from the earth during earthquakes, And you have essentially World War One on the Pacific Ocean happening a decade earlier than it happened in our timeline, because you have America and Japan are allied as a world power, and they're taking over mainland Asia, and they're in the process of taking over China.
Right.
And so you have this world power effects, you know, going on in the background, because you have Britannia trying to subdue India. You have Russia just making noises over there, wanting to take over Asia too. So you have all these dynamics in the background. And then there's Ingrid with her profound geomancy powers, and bad people found out about her powers, and she's on the run for her life along with Sai and Fenris, and they flee to the Pacific Northwest, and the book goes into Portland and Seattle, which, of course, if you know the Pacific Rim area,
right,
those are also areas very prone to earthquakes, mm-hmm, and also, yes, volcanic activity.
Yeah, exactly. The Ring of Fire is in that area.
Yeah. Yes. So she knows that she's in a very dangerous place, but she's trying to find out answers about why she is as powerful as she is, who her father really was, and at the same time try to escape the Unified Pacific forces that would use her for very ill ends.
Right. Wow. I'm excited. I can't wait to read it. I'm very excited about seeing the next book and seeing where it goes. And then you tell me there's a third book that's going to be.
Yes. Aurora of Sky next year.
Yeah. I'm going to be like I am with Jeannie's books. I read it in the first week, and then I have to wait for 6 months.
I know, but
is torture.
So then let me ask this. Was this originally intended to be a trilogy, or do you think it could be open-ended, that maybe there is more story to tell?
It is a trilogy at this point, but when I first started writing, I did not know if it was going to be a duology or a trilogy.
Uh-huh.
And my original book deal was for just two books.
Ah, so you had to add a third one. There was more story there than you had anticipated.
Yeah, which was scary too, because I wrote the second book and fulfilled my contract, and then it was a matter of waiting on pins and needles and, you know, please let my editor want a third book. Please let my editor want a third book. Otherwise, it would have been left hanging. And mm-hmm. I've had other writer friends that's happened to, where their books have been orphaned, and it's a horrible and terrifying position to be in. But thankfully, yeah, Harper Voyager wanted the third book. So, yay.
That is a good thing. I'm excited. I didn't know it was a trilogy. I thought it was just two. So initially, but it's good to know that there's more. I have to pick up some more of your work and read the rest of it. So,
do you have any thoughts about what you might want to do, or are there any other ideas outside of this trilogy that are beginning to take root in your head?
Well, that's where I am right now. I'm brainstorming to see what I want to do next. So, yeah, I'm mulling through different ideas, and I'm going to need to have a good talk with my agent about that and see what we want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, and like I said, if ideas start to come into your mind that maybe there is more story to tell, would you be willing to actually continue on with this this series of books that you're writing right now? Because to me, I mean, like I said, I've only read the first chapter. But when I just look at the world that this story is taking place in, I kind of get the sense that there could be a lot more story there.
Or at least tangential stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you always, you know, you write the end, but then there's always that question mark because, yeah, any
really
novel
the
world, I think you have room for expansion. And that's true for my Blood of Earth series, which is the name of this trilogy, and also my Clockwork Dagger duology, which is my previous series.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Cool. And I've had people actually ask me to write more Clockwork Dagger books, and I don't have any firm ideas in that realm yet, but I do have a short story and novella collection that is released in that world.
Oh, cool.
So I expanded on that world in that way.
Oh, good. That would be something that you could possibly do with this, should it take off and be exciting, or...
Yeah, and there's anything's possible.
Yeah.
Cool.
So if anybody wanted to kind of learn more about you or your books. So first off, where are your books available at?
Pretty much everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They're an ebook. They're in trade paperback. Mm-hmm. They are not an audiobook, unfortunately. I get asked that a lot. But yeah, anywhere you look online, and also just to throw out there, that's also available in a lot of libraries.
Mm-hmm.
I know locally it's in the Phoenix Library System and the Buckeye Library System, Goodyear, I think. So, I mean, I think it's even in libraries in New Zealand. World, I mean, it's worldwide.
Far out. Well, that's nice to know. You're internationally recognized.
Yay.
So if people wanted to know more about you and maybe where you're at any particular stage of the riding, what kind, do you have any social media presence that people could learn more about where you're at and what you're doing?
Yeah, if they go to BethCato.com, and that's Cato spelled C-A-T-O, they go there. You can find me on Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter and Facebook and Pinterest, which is a lot of recipes on there, especially.
Oh, Keith, did you hear that?
But
recipes on Pinterest.
My website, I'm very active. I keep a blog on there. You can find information on all of my books, including links to a lot of online bookstores. And then every Wednesday, I post a new recipe as part of my Bready or Not food blog series.
Okay, so now we got to go on the tangent. Yeah. What are some of your favorite recipes?
My favorite recipes?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Well, I do love making cookie recipes.
Okay,
cool.
And I'm known for my cookie recipes because I guess if I'm going to have a reputation for something, let it be cookies, right?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, so, we'll keep that in mind. But yeah, we'll definitely be checking out that out.
And you did
that as well.
Facebook and Twitter, is it?
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Facebook and Twitter. Those are my main ones. And Pinterest and a little bit of posting on Google as well.
All righty then. Google Plus. That sounds fantastic. Right. Well, thank you, Beth Cato. I look forward to finishing off this first book and then diving into the rest. Like I said, that first chapter really grabbed me. It is so well written that I'm just so excited to see where the rest of this story will go.
I can't wait to see the second book and the third.
You can get the second book now. I mean, it is out.
Well, no, it's not out yet.
The second book isn't out yet?
No, it's not.
August 15th.
Oh, I thought the third book was coming out on August 15th.
Next year, third book.
Okay, I stand corrected.
Look on my website. You'll see what's out now and all that information, all that good stuff.
Got it. Right. Okay.
Well, thank you, Beth Cato, for being on the show this time.
Well, thank you. It's been so nice talking with you two again.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
This is Beth Cato, author of Breath of Earth and Call of Fire. You're listening to The Two Gay Geeks.
And here's a few selected birthdays for July 24th through July 30th, 2017. July 24th, Linda Carter.
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman.
Yes. And also on July 24th, Ruth Buzzy.
The original Wonder Woman.
The original Wonder Woman, yeah.
With her powerful purse.
Her powerful purse.
Her magic purse that she would smack people with.
She would smack Artie Johnson.
Artie Johnson with,
as the old man, the cock-a-doodle-poo-poo man.
Oh, I've seen her slap, you know.
She slapped everybody.
She slapped everybody, you know, on Laughing with that, you know, as that character.
Yeah. Also on July 24th, Alexandre Dumas, born in 1802.
Author of... a lot of stuff.
A lot of stuff.
The Three Musketeers.
Yep. And Les Miserables.
I thought it was Victor Hugo.
Oh, that was Victor. That's right. I'm sorry.
But I almost made the same mistake. I caught myself in the last second. So believe me, I would have said the same thing if you hadn't.
Silly me. Okay, moving right along. July 25th, Estelle Getty and Walter Brennan. It's Walter Brennan that I always get confused with.
Walter Matthau. Oh, my God. See what you got me doing now.
Oh, my gosh. Let's move along. Anyway, July 26th.
Canley Stubrick.
Canley Stubrick. Yeah. Stanley Kubrick.
Now.
Yes.
Oh, I can't mess up Vivian Vance.
And Vivian Vance. Helen Mirren. Kevin Spacey, Roger Taylor.
Which Roger Taylor?
The Roger Taylor drummer.
Okay, so that's nice how just last week we had Dr. Brian May's birthday. And this time, and you know, actually we could almost call him Dr. Roger Taylor because he was originally studying to be a dentist.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow, interesting. All right. And also on July 26th is Blake Edwards. Director of one of our favorite films, Victoria. Yes, with his wife.
With Julie Andrews. Yes. Plus he's, you know, the Pink Panther films, which are like, those are just, you know, outrageous.
Oh, yeah. Also on July 26th, George Bernard Shaw, born in 1856. He was the author of Gone with the Wind. No,
what?
Since we're messing everything up.
See, he did Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Yes, he did. Yes, he the Pygmalion, yeah.
Yes, which was My Fair Lady.
That's right.
Anybody who doesn't know, who doesn't read it in English anymore in high school.
We did.
Oh, yeah, we read it in...
I agonized through it.
Oh, exactly. July 27th, Norman Lear and Keenan Wynn. July 28th, Jackie O, Jacqueline Kennedy, Bouvier Kennedy Onassis.
Wow, I'm glad you pulled that one out.
Yes. Also on July 28th, Beatrix Potter.
Okay, now I gotta stop on that. Beatrix, I thought it was Beatrix Lestrange.
No, Beatrix Potter. She was the author.
Oh.
Yes.
No relation to Beatrix Lestrange or Harry Potter.
No.
Oh.
No, Beatrix Potter.
Okay.
No.
I just had to be sure.
Yes. Also on July 28th, Graham Denman of Clowntown.
Wow. Boy, I hope we see more of Clowntown.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. We saw that,
it was two years ago at Horrible Imaginings.
Horrible Imaginings, yeah. Yes. July 29th, Mr. Will Wheaton, Mr. Geddy Lee, and David Warner. July 30th, Alton Brown and Arnold.
Arnold. I'll be back.
Yes. Henry Ford in 1863, and a very good friend of ours, Mr. Brendan Mahoney. Happy birthday. And that's the end of the birthdays this time.
Technorama, the podcast for geeks, because geeks are better than cool. You don't hear someone say, "Get away from me, you cool person." Who's gonna have their 65-inch home theater system installed by the cool squad?
Not me,
that's for sure. How much cool cred do you have? Not enough to care about. Think you'll find any canned unicorn meat at thinkcool.com? It's just a park domain name. They don't even have roadkill in a paper cup. That's why you need to start listening to Technorama, because that's what geeks do. Go to chuckchat.com and listen to Technorama before you turn cool.
Oh, heaven forbid.
Go give a listen to our friends Chuck and Craig over at the Cool Squad.
Yeah.
Or the
Geek Squad.
The Geek. No, they can't say that.
No, that's Best Buy.
Anyway, go give a listen at chuckchat.com. Technorama. And now, I'm going to cut this one short because we only have a little feedback.
Which is tiny, tiny, tiny bit of feedback. And this is in regards to what we talked about last week. There's a new doctor, and her name is Jodie Whittaker. And a friend of ours, Tom King, who we met at a Disney cruise a few years back. Actually, you met him before I did.
Yeah.
You met him in line for coffee at
in
Vancouver.
Actually, yeah. They were at the Starbucks. Before the Starbucks opened, we just were chatting and it was kind of drizzly.
Wasn't there some Disney clothing that gave it away or something?
Yeah, yeah. And said, "Are you going on a cruise?" And I said, "Yes, we are." And so we got to chatting with him and we saw him in line as we were getting ready to get on the ship. And then we just kind of palled around with him on that whole cruise.
Yeah. I mean, oh gosh, some of the nightclub stuff was a little crazy.
Yeah.
That was great fun. Yeah. But anyway, Tom King writes, "We just started binge watching Broadchurch on Netflix to get a feel for this actress. You know, it's not a bad idea."
Yeah.
Right. I've heard good things about Broadchurch and, you know, David Tennant's always a great actor.
Oh yeah.
So we might have to check that out. So that's our feedback.
That's our feedback. We want to hear from you if you want to comment on our episodes, on any articles that we have, as Tom did. You can do that on our website at tggeeks.com. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can comment on our YouTube. You can call us on our listener feedback line at 469-TGGEEKS. That's 469-844-3357. Please play nice.
This is Mark Biaggi, and you're listening to TG Geeks Webcast. Get your geek on.
Oh my God, I haven't heard that in years.
Yeah.
I almost forgot what his regular voice sounded like.
Yeah. Yeah, we played all of his other voiceover.
Yeah, because he's for anybody who needs remembering or reminding. Yeah, he's primarily a voiceover artist.
Yeah, voiceover actor.
He's very, very talented, very gifted, and yeah, he's done the Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's done our Austin Powers bumper.
Among other things.
Among other things.
We have a bunch of them in there.
Yeah, there's still a bunch. I think there's still some we haven't played yet.
Yeah.
So anyway, we didn't get a chance to really cover all of this. We only kind of hemmed and hawed at it on our last episode. But last weekend, D23. Lots of big stuff came down.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we're going to have the link for this in our show notes at tggeeks.com as well as in this episode. But we're only going to cover some in this little episode here. We're only going to cover some of the things that really kind of leapt out at me. The first thing is the Star Wars land.
Oh my gosh!
What's that being? Well, that's going to be called Galaxy's Edge, for starters. And let's see. Apparently, according to the Walt Disney Parks and Resorts chairman, Bob Chapek, he took the D23 stage to talk about the new theme park land. And basically he says that it is set in an isolated trading outpost in a galaxy far, far away. Why can't it be a galaxy like now? Where the First Order and the Resistance are battling it out. So now we know this puts this in the time of Force Awakens, Last Jedi. So this is taking place in the trilogy that's now being produced for the theaters.
Why can't it be a galaxy near to here?
I think that's going over in DCA.
Oh, there we are.
Yeah, that's called Marvel Land.
But
we'll get to that later. Anyway, after offering an up-close and personal look at the expansive model that was on display at the D23 show floor, I mean, and it really looks kind of nice. They had done some kind of a video flyover. Anyway, they gave some concept art.
Yeah, they had some concept art. I really hope they can get that moon over the...
Ooh. Well, that would be some real serious Disney magic, I'm telling you. They can actually pull that off. But anyway, some of the art teases moments between Chewbacca and Hondo from Star Wars Rebels. Oh my goodness gracious me. There's the artwork is just kind of like all over the place. But anyway, the whole thing, it's described as a remote frontier outpost. Planet has existed within the canon for thousands and thousands of years. It used to be a vibrant spaceport. But since the advent of hyperspace, commerce has kind of fallen off a little bit. Oh my God, it's the Route 66 of Star Wars.
There we go.
That's what this is.
How about that?
So this needs to be near Cars Land.
Yeah.
Cars, Star Wars. Yeah, okay. Cars. I'm trying to play a bad pun here.
Cars Wars Lands.
Yeah, that's it. Anyway, this is a crossroads in the galaxy, a place where all of us are welcomed as guests and visitors. But for those wanting to delve deeper, there will be lots of opportunities. You can help the Resistance, be recruited by a bounty hunter or smuggler for a side job, or even join the First Order. You will be able to explore, feel, smell, and taste the world of Star Wars. You can explore the streets and markets, buy strange meat concoctions, drink in weird vessels, drink a glass of blue milk. Yay! I'm living for the blue milk. That's all I have to say. Haven't we all been since we first saw the
exactly.
You know, episode
I was
4?
17.
Yeah, ever since the first movie came out in 77, I've just wanted to have some of that blue milk.
Blue milk.
Yeah. And there's also a piece of concept art that shows a pod racer engine, which has been repurposed in a market restaurant to grill meat.
Oh.
You know, and we've talked about this in the past. Some of the neat things they're going to do here is the cast members that are working in Galaxy's Edge, they're not going to be playing the part. You know, they're not going to be like Disney employees like you see throughout, you know, any of the other places. They're not like that. I mean, they're going to be playing characters.
They're actually going to be cast members.
They'll be acting. But I think this is a great idea. My only concern is... and this is going to be a problem when Galaxy's Edge first opens up because that park is going to
be
overrun.
Massive.
It's going to be overrun. I think in order to really make this work, they need to have, you know, I hate to say this, but they need to put a population cap on there.
Yeah.
You know, a crowd cap in order to be able to give guests the kind of experience they possibly want.
Yeah.
However, We got a story coming up later that might kind of offset some of this.
Yeah.
Now, the construction on the parks has already begun. Both parks for here and Orlando are scheduled to open in 2019. So keep your eyes open for that. I'm very excited about it. Now, moving over to the East Coast, a new ride is coming to the Magic Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Tron. The roller coaster ride. It's called. The Disney Parks and Resorts Chairman Bob Chapek. He announced at D23 again that the popular Tron Light Cycle Power Run that debuted at Shanghai Disneyland is coming to Magic Kingdom in Orlando.
Oh, wow. Cool.
They're going to put it next to Space Mountain.
Oh, that will be fun.
Yeah. So this will be adding another e-ticket attraction. And for anybody who doesn't know what e-ticket attraction means...
Is that going in that... There's that blank spot, or there's also where Carousel of Progress...
Carousel of Progress is on the other side. There's a conceptual map showing where it's going to be. You got the Carousel of Progress on one side, you got Space Mountain on another, and then Space Mountain will be in between the two, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, I see. So it's going on the other side of Space Mountain.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So Space Mountain will be in between Tron
because there's nothing
and
over
Carousel
there.
Of Progress, because there's nothing there.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember the last time we were in Orlando, I made the comment about, you know, I love coming into Tomorrowland, but you hit this one area near Space Mountain and it's just barren.
Well, on either side, because there's quite a bit of space between Space Mountain and Carousel of Progress. There's just that little area. There's the bathrooms there, and there's a little stage-like thing.
Yeah, there's a stage area there, which I don't think really that they're not doing anything with anymore. Yeah. So there's plenty of real estate that they can use in order to build this.
That'd be cool.
And it's probably, I would imagine, they have the opportunity to make it at least as big as Shanghai's, if not bigger.
Yeah.
Because they've got the space to do it. So that will be coming. And we will have in the article for this story, there is a high definition Tron coaster ride through from Shanghai.
Oh, cool.
And they're designed like the light cycles that we saw in the Tron films. So check that out. Currently, there's no set date for the Tron ride to open at Magic Kingdom in Orlando. However, the popular idea is that it's going to arrive in 2021 because that will be in time for Disney World or the Magic Kingdom's 50th anniversary.
Wow.
So that makes perfect sense. And right now, as it is, you know, with all the big effort that Disney World is doing with their end of Star Wars, I imagine that, you know, this is kind of like a tiny bit on the back burner.
Yeah.
So now, moving back to the West Coast, to Anaheim. They started this off already when over at Disney's California Adventure, they got rid of the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, which some of us are still smarting over.
Yeah.
However, they did replace it with, good grief.
Mission Breakout.
Mission Breakout. Thank you.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it's a Guardians of the Galaxy ride, Mission Breakout. And I always kind of had a little bit of a weird vibe about this because the building itself looks awesome. It's just ill-placed.
Yeah.
However, they did something which a lot of rumors were kind of circulating about for the past month or so. Adjacent to the Twilight Zone, what used to be Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, was a little area called Bugs Land. This was, you know, sort of like a little mini theme park area for tiny tots. Because in the beginning, California Adventure really didn't have much available for children. Well, that's going away. And that whole area is now going to be turned into Marvel Land.
Marvel Land.
Yes.
It's now, a Marvel.
Yes. Now, people may remember that Disney had been teaming theme park fans with a mysterious hatch that was located just outside of Mission Breakout, which featured the Avengers logo, and it kind of looked like it was hiding something.
Mm.
Now, the hatch was brought up again at D23, and yes, it was a teaser of sorts for an entire Marvel Land that is going to grow around this ride, and it sort of needs to happen soon. Because, yes, it sticks out. If you go down the Hollywood backlot area, or what you call, I don't know what you call it, Hollywood Boulevard, this thing just kind of sticks out there and it doesn't fit. So you need to have this whole Marvel thing going on in order to give it some kind of continuity to the park. Anyway, again, Bob Chapek, he made the official announcement alongside a very adorable animatronic baby Groot, who kept saying, "I am Groot."
I am Groot.
Imagine that. Chapek was a little bit more.
I am Groot.
Yeah, he was a little bit more loose-lipped.
I am Groot.
Than Groot was.
I am Groot.
Noting that the Avengers and Spider-Man are both going to play a role in this completely immersive superhero universe that will allow guests to team up with your heroes in never ways ever seen before, while new stories build on the Mission Breakout. So I think they're taking a page out of the Star Tours attraction over at Disneyland and coming up with new ways to tell new stories inside of Mission Breakout. I think that's kind of a neat idea. Anyway, the theme park land will be based on Marvel properties, and it's going to be a slightly trickier proposition than a lot of people think, because Disney, while they own Marvel, the theme park characters are not owned by Marvel. They're owned by Universal.
Mm.
So there's got to be, I think there's going to be some negotiating that's got to take place here, determine rights, all of that. So this, it might take a little bit of time before they finally get this going. But in any case, that is the plan, to actually bring more Marvel to Disneyland because, well, it's a gold mine.
I am Groot.
Thank you. Moving right along. And this is the one that I'm really excited about. We talked earlier about the immersive Star Wars experience that people can get at the Galaxy's Edge at both Disneyland and Disney World. Well, at Disney World, they are also building two resort hotels that will allow immersive stays for both Marvel and Star Wars.
Yay.
Now, this I am OMG.
Yeah.
Seriously, my geek bone is just quivering like mad. I mean, this really is, I am excited about this. So here we are. Again, at D23, Bob Chapek promised a revolutionary vacation experience that will immerse guests in the worlds of their favorite characters. Now, first, the hotel available stateside is the one in a galaxy far, far away. I should add that the Marvel one, that's for Paris.
Yeah.
Apparently. But the Star Wars one, this is the one that I really want to do.
That's the one near to here.
Near to here, because it's going to be over in Orlando. And
nearer to here.
Yes. Now, what they can, it's a luxury resort with an immersion in an authentic Star Wars environment. I like this because being in a hotel, well.
Wasn't that a Star Trek episode, Nearer?
No. No. I'm ignoring you. At least I'm
as
ignoring
you
that.
Do.
I'm ignoring that. It's like, I can't believe you just said that.
Well, it's and that's
what. Well, I suppose, yeah. But you know that's why I just kind of paused there, because I thought, did he just say? Did he just go there? And apparently, he did.
I did.
Anyway, first,
it's my job.
It's your job to completely derail me. Anyway, this is a Star Wars inspired resort that will be at Disney World. It combines a luxury resort with an immersion in an authentic Star Wars environment.
This sounds great.
This sounds so amazing. Guests can experience a multi-day adventure in space and the planets that populate the Star Wars universe and become an active citizen of the galaxy, complete with proper attire provided to them. You will board a starship alive with stories and adventures.
Yay.
Now, there's tons of concept art. We've already run some of this because there was a rumor about this. There was a survey that was being conducted, and we ran a story on that, and we talked about it, and we just kind of said, yeah, this is a really great idea. But we will run this again, including the concept art, so you can find the link for that in the show notes. The concept art for the Star Wars Hotel includes windows that imitate outer space, characters like R2-D2 and various aliens walking about the resort, and cool beds and rooms by the design of BB-8. BB-8 is the architect?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. So, but for those people who want to travel abroad, over at Disneyland Paris, Disney is reimagining their former Hotel New York into New York The Art of Marvel. And they're going to create a hotel at the Disneyland Paris that would make Tony Stark proud. The hotel will transport guests to the inspiring world of the superheroes, including Iron Man, the Avengers, Spider-Man, among others. Guests will be able to explore the Marvel Universe through art, films, superhero costumes, and more, all in a contemporary art gallery.
And the concept art looks really great, too.
The concept art looks really fantastic on that one, too. Now, I got to go back to the Star Wars one, because this is the one that I'm just really, really jazzed over. The idea of creating this kind of immersive experience, if they could find some way to tie that into Galaxy's Edge.
Oh, wow.
That would be mind-blowing.
Yeah, that would be great.
Now, I could see...
If they had the hotel was... you walk out of the hotel...
Into...
If that could be a new gate for...
That would be a phenomenal idea. Yeah. I don't know quite how the resort map actually works out, because if my understanding is correct, Galaxy Edge, that's part of Disney Studio.
Right. But there's room there.
There's a number of hotels that are there, and they might be able to give them access via the waterway.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, it could be themed as a
because there are water taxis that go in and out of Disney Studio, because we've taken them before.
Right.
So there's a possibility there. I would really like to see how they're going to do this. But even if they can't, I still think. I mean, hell, I would be in the hotel and I wouldn't want to leave.
Yeah.
Especially if there is a story that I get pulled into, and that's the idea of getting guests pulled into this. I think this is a marvelous idea, and I would think that this could also be a great way to have, you know, sort of create a crowd control situation.
For an additional cost.
For an additional cost, I agree. But nonetheless, this is something that I desperately want to do.
Yeah.
Right now, I don't really see a release date in the story. There's nothing there at the present time. But I love the little tag. And this says, what they're doing is they're basically creating a world where you never have to leave.
Yep.
And I wouldn't want to, especially that Star Wars one. And when we originally ran the survey story on our website, we had some comments back coming from friends who were saying, you know, sign me up now.
Yeah, this is more than blue sky. This is
this is in the plans now. This is in the development, because this was fully announced at D23. This isn't a pie in the sky kind of idea.
Yeah, well, now they've got blue sky is their terminology for things that we want to do.
Right. This
things
has gone,
we think about.
Well, and I think at the when this was at the survey level is when it was still in the blue sky kind of realm.
Right.
But obviously, you know, and I knew that when it was announced that they were doing surveys on this, that the response was going to be overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah.
Here we are. So there it is. As soon as we learn more, we will be happy to share it with all of you.
Yep. And our follow-up items, as always, thank you to whoever nominated us for the Parsec Award. They're still in the judging process, so thank you for doing that for us. Check out our calendar on the website. If you have a birthday or in a con or a film festival or whatnot, send us a note. We'll put it on that calendar. Come see us and say hi. We'll be at the following events: Horrible Imaginings Film Festival in San Diego on Saturday, September 9th. OperaCon by Arizona Opera on October 21st. And Phoenix Comic-Con Fan Fest November 11th and 12th. And as everybody knows, we're huge supporters of independent creators, whether it be filmmakers, comic book artists, or writers, or any other types of independent creators. There's a lot of talent out there, and they don't get a lot of the big money or fame, and sometimes they do crowdfunding opportunities, mm-hmm. and if they do, and you hear about it, please consider supporting them with that. Sometimes you can get in for as little as a dollar.
We have done that, and yeah. in some cases, it has been very much worthwhile.
A big thing, yeah. So support independent creators. Phoenix Comic-Con Fan Fest is on November 11th and 12th. At this point of recording of this episode, there's not information this point. But keep checking phoenixcomiccon.com. And regular Phoenix Comic-Con is May 24th through 27th, 2018. And as we talked about earlier, OperaCon by Arizona Opera is on October 21st. There's going to be several events planned prior to the performance of Hercules versus the Vampires that evening.
That's going to be such a fun day. I'm really excited about it. It's going to be great.
Stay tuned for more. We're in the planning stages or helping with the planning of that. And for more information about Arizona Opera, check out azopera.org.
Special thanks to Doctor Who Talking Who on Twitter. They publish the Doctor Who Fancast Guide that frequently republishes our stories, and we thank them for that. You can find Doctor Who Fancast Guide by going to Twitter, looking for @TalkingWho. Special thanks to Brian Weber. On Twitter, he is the Nazi Punching Scald, and he publishes the Arkle Times Post Dispatch News that also frequently republishes our stories as well. And you can find that by going to Twitter and looking for @Arkle, A-R-K-L-E. And he also has the incorrect Star Trek Voyager quotes on Tumblr. You can check that out for yourself, but just make sure your boss isn't looking over your shoulder when you do it. Special thanks to Sci-Fi Obsession on Facebook for also republishing our stories. They can be found at facebook.com/sci-fi-ob. That is S-C-I-F-I-O-B.
And we give a shout out to The Lookie Show on Twitter and @Lookie Show and their show on YouTube. Just check out Lookie Show. They do reviews of movies in a rather unique fashion. Back to you. Sorry.
That's me. And of course, always a special shout out to our favorite Facebook group, The Gay Geek, because they allow us to publish our episodes there. It's a fantastic group. I love checking that group out. Lots of great content, lots of really good conversation. And you can find them by going to facebook.com/groups/The Gay Geek with, as always, our undying thanks to Jeremiah Reeves for giving us permission to share our episodes there.
Yes, thanks, Jeremiah. We want to remind you to occasionally click on our Amazon ads. We've got quite a few of them always on in the widgets and at the bottom of each article and each episode. Doesn't cost anything, and you don't have to buy anything, but if you do choose to buy something, use one of our search ads. It gets us a little kickback. And lastly, please rate us and review us on iTunes and subscribe to our YouTube channel.
Please.
Who knows what we'll have next time? Probably our wrap-up.
It's going to be a wrap-up of San Diego Comic-Con.
Yeah.
Because, among other things. Among other things. I mean, you never know what we might be bringing with us. But yeah, it's going to be probably the San Diego Comic-Con breakdown. Yep.
All right, that should do it for this episode of TG Geeks Webcast. Be sure to check out the article for this webcast episode. We'll have several links on the page. And remember, you can comment on our Facebook page or our website, tggeeks.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 469-TG-GEEKS. That is 469-844-3357. Thanks for listening. I'm Keith Lane from TG Squared Studios. I bid you peace.
Cheers.